Hello, my name is Jody Lamont, and welcome to Dream Gardens, where we talk up the kids' books we love. On this twice-monthly podcast, I interview other kids' books enthusiasts, such as writers, teachers, and librarians, about their own favorite children's books. On the last podcast, as a way of introducing the focus book, Alice in Wonderland, I read a nonsense poem by Edward Lear. It seemed appropriate to the book being discussed at the time. I'd like to follow that up with another poem, one that appears in Lewis Carroll's sequel to the Wonderland book, Through the Looking Glass. That poem is called The Walrus and the Carpenter, and while it doesn't have anything to do with the book featured on this podcast, except for a brief mention of kings, it is one of my favorites, and for no better reason than that, I'm going to read it. The Walrus and the Carpenter by Lewis Carroll. The sun was shining on the sea, shining with all his might. He did his very best to make the billows smooth and bright, and this was odd because it was the middle of the night. The moon was shining sulkily because she thought the sun had no business to be there after the day was done. It's very rude of him, she said, to come and spoil the fun. The sea was wet as wet could be, the sands were dry as dry. You could not see a cloud because no cloud was in the sky. No birds were flying overhead, there were no birds to fly. The walrus and the carpenter were walking close at hand. They wept like anything to see such quantities of sand. If this were only cleared away, they said, it would be grand. If 7 maids with 7 mops swept it for half a year, do you suppose, the walrus said, that they could get it clear? I doubt it, said the carpenter, and shed a bitter tear. Oh, oysters, come and walk with us, the walrus did beseech. A pleasant walk, a pleasant talk along the briny beach. We cannot do with more than 4 to give a hand to each. The eldest oyster looked at him, but never a word he said. The eldest oyster winked his eye and shook his heavy head, meaning to say he did not choose to leave the oyster bed. But 4 young oysters hurried up, all eager for the treat. Their coats were brushed, their faces washed, their shoes were clean and neat, and this was odd because, you know, they hadn't any feet. 4 other oysters followed them, and yet another 4. And thick and fast they came at last, and more and more and more, all hopping through the frothy waves and scrambling to the shore. The walrus and the carpenter walked on a mile or so, and then they rested on a rock conveniently low, and all the little oysters stood and waited in a row. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings. But wait a bit, the oysters cried, before we have our chat, for some of us are out of breath, and all of us are fat. No hurry, said the carpenter. They thanked him much for that. A loaf of bread, the walrus said, is what we chiefly need. Pepper and vinegar, besides, are very good indeed. Now if you're ready, oysters, dear, we can begin to feed. But not on us, the oysters cried, turning a little blue. After such kindness, that would be a dismal thing to do. The night is fine, the walrus said. Do you admire the view? It was so kind of you to come, and you are very nice. The carpenter said nothing, but cut us another slice. I wish you were not quite so deaf. I've had to ask you twice. It seems a shame, the walrus said, to play them such a trick. After we brought them out so far and made them trot so quick. The carpenter said nothing, but the butter spread too thick. I weep for you, the walrus said. I deeply sympathize. With sobs and tears he sorted out those of the largest size, holding his pocket handkerchief before his streaming eyes. "Oh, oysters," said the carpenter, "you've had a pleasant run. Shall we be trotting home again?" But answer there came none. And this was scarcely odd, because they'd eaten every one. My guest today is author Andrea Mack, author of several picture books, such as Let's Ride, the Joy of the Tomboy series, and Super Tim Saves the Day. She's written many articles and stories for educational publishers, as well as beginning readers for ESL students. You can find Andrea's website at andreamack.blogspot.com. Thank you for joining me today, Andrea.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, as I've mentioned, you've written a number of books that are geared specifically for the classroom. I was wondering, what are the sort of challenges and rewards for that kind of writing?
It is actually quite challenging because you're trying to keep the word count down. And since the books that I've written were for English second language learners, you have to use vocabulary that is at a level they would understand. So that can be quite challenging to get an idea across.
And do you start with like a list of words, particular words you want to include, and then try to build a story from that? Or start with a story and then think about what vocabulary would work best?
I usually start with the story. I like to come up with an interesting idea. And the publishers that I was working for in Korea sometimes suggested ideas, but mostly I would come up with the idea and then I would have to try and like write it in a way that sometimes it would like showcase a certain kind of phrase, or sometimes it's just more just writing it simply enough to get an idea across, but also make an interesting story.
Do you find certain kinds of stories work better than others for these particular kinds of books?
Yeah, I guess you usually have to have like a problem, and like a kind of a clear problem and a solution, and you don't want to have like too much secondary detail, I guess. So, you know, you want the story to be very clear and easy to follow. And also for the English second language learner books that I was writing, it's a little bit different than writing picture books for the like the general trade market, because you can't rely on the picture to tell everything. They wanted everything to be in the text. Whereas if you're writing like a picture book for a big publishing company, you're a partner with the illustrator, so you have to leave lots of room for the illustrator. But in the case of the books that I was writing for English language learners, they want everything to be in the text, and then they illustrate from that. So it was a bit different.
Do you have a favorite book that you've written?
It's hard to pick a favorite, right? My favorite is always the one I'm working on at the moment, I would say. But I get a lot of ideas from, you know, I had a lot of ideas from my children, like when they were growing up, because I did a lot of it when they were young. So things that happened in our family or whatever, I would get a spark of an idea and then that might turn into a story.
Now, you've written a lot of these for the educational market, and you're starting to write some more middle grade books. And I'm wondering what kind of an adjustment that's been to do this different type of writing.
I think what happened is my children got older, so I start like they are always like my first reader in mind, and they got older, so I wanted to write more complicated books that they would be able to read. So that's what started me off on it, but I kind of stuck at that level, and when they moved on to YA, I stayed at middle grade because I really enjoy that. And I started to do research for my writing. I ended up starting to do a lot of reading of middle grade books, and I've done quite a lot of that and studying them. And I had like a 100 book challenge to read 100 of them in a year. And then I started doing reviews of them and studying them a little bit more. And I just really enjoy them because they have such good writing and good stories.
Now, the book you chose as one of your favorites is called The False Prince by Jennifer A. Nielsen, and it was published in 2012 by Scholastic Press. And this is actually the first book of the Ascendance Trilogy, or what's called the Ascendance Trilogy. And the other two books in that are The Runaway King and The Shadow. For readers who might not be familiar with this book, what can you tell them about it?
Well, when I first read it, this book really stood out to me as different. I hadn't read many middle grade books before where the narrator kind of leaves out key parts of the story as you go along, and it really made the story very exciting. It's full of surprises and it's twisty, and even if you kind of guess the big surprise, which I didn't, but my daughter did, you still want to keep reading to see how it's going to turn out. In the Kingdom of Carthia, there's a civil war coming and people are kind of dissatisfied with how the king is managing things. And one of the noblemen, Connor, has come up with a plan and he wants to take over. So what he's trying to do is to find a boy to impersonate the king's long lost son. Then he wants to get him to be on the throne as the prince, but a false prince. So this nobleman Connor goes to four orphanages and he finds four boys who resemble the long lost prince. And then he trains them to act like the missing prince, like by teaching them horse riding and horseback riding and sword fighting and like how to act in the palace and one of the boys of the four is quickly eliminated. So there's three boys left trying to be the prince. And the main character, Sage, he's kind of dragged into a little bit because he thinks of it as an act of treason. But he really doesn't have a choice, because if he doesn't go along with this plan, he's going to be killed. So he does go along with it. But luckily, he has his own clever plan. And so there's lots of action and swordplay and little mystery in this book. So it's a really, really good book. And it's kind of a quick read, and you really want to keep reading it, I found.
Now, speaking of Sage, you know, he's this poor orphan. He's also, you know, a thief. He steals things sometimes. He's kind of a smart aleck at times. And so, but what makes him, despite all that, what makes him the hero?
Yeah, well, I think underneath all of that, he's really kind of a very caring person, and you see little bits of that as you go through the story. But and he's also very smart and clever, and he has interesting schemes and plans for, you know, what he's going to do. And I really enjoyed that. There were a lot of twists and turns because of that, and I didn't really see them coming.
Well, a big theme of this book is deception, you know, whether it's necessary sometimes to use deception to achieve a particular end. And it's used for a variety of means. On one hand, you've got, as you mentioned, Connor's plan to prop up this pretender prince. And on the other hand, you have someone like the servant girl, Imogene, who pretends to be mute so she can stay out of trouble. I'm wondering if you get an idea from the author that deception can be a good thing, or it's a bad thing, or is it just a more complicated than either one of those generalities?
That's a really interesting question, because there is a lot of, like, almost everyone, every character practically in this story has some kind of secret. For sure, sometimes I think the deception worked to their advantage, right? Because they had a good goal in the end, whereas Connor's goal was not quite so good. In this story, at times, you really don't know who to trust as the reader, because you never really seem to have the full story until you get to the end. So I think that kind of creates a little bit of tension even between the book and the reader. And all the characters have secrets from each other in their own mind. So yeah, it's really interesting.
Now, there is one person that Sage does end up trusting. As I mentioned, Imogene, the servant, is the one person that almost immediately feels he can trust. So what is it about Imogene amongst all this other people who he doesn't trust at all that he feels he can kind of let down his guard and trust her in some way? What is it about her?
She seems to have, like, she herself has a pretty strong personality. She doesn't let herself get pushed around too much, although she does in her job. But she has a really strong sense of independence, and maybe he can connect to that a little bit. And she seems like, I guess she's basically an orphan, as he is. So they have some kind of a connection there.
And this book, I was thinking as I was reading it, it reminded me of other books where somebody pretends to be a member of royalty or is going to try to pretend. I think of books like The Prince and the Pauper and The Man in the Iron Mask, and there's probably a few others as well. I'm wondering, thinking about those books and any others, what do you think sets this book apart from those? It's a similar theme, but it's its own thing as well.
I thought a little bit about The Prince and the Pauper when I was reading this, actually, because it is kind of a similar story, but not really, because he has all these other people, I guess, that he relies on. Like, I guess what's really great about this book is the voice of Sage. Like, he's just so clever, and he's funny and witty, and, you know, even though he's a bit smart alecky, you kind of see underneath that he at times that he's a little bit more caring, and he's just a little bit more fun character. And I think that makes the book kind of exciting to read. And, you know, at the same, he's always kind of sizing people up, but at the same time he's helping people. Like, he tries to help Imogene a lot. And I also liked in this book, like, how there are all kinds of, like, small details in the book which come to play a bigger role in the story, but you don't know it at the time. The author has done a really good job of, like putting those in the right place so you notice them a little bit, but then you don't really realize they're important until you get to the end later, and it, it comes as kind of a little bit of a surprise. So that's really cool.
The biggest part of this book, the bulk of it, the middle part of the book really, deals with the various preparations the boys have to go through in order to figure out who's going to be chosen to pretend to be the prince. I was thinking this is the part in many books that might sort of be summarized in some way, or you think about a movie, it'd be the montage scene, you know?
Yeah.
But in this one, it's actually the largest part of the book. What do you think the advantage of, in this particular story, spending so much time on the preparation?
It's true, but I think that's kind of, you know, part of the story that they're trying to train him to act like the missing prince, and it shows along the way, like there are little clues dropped as to what might happen, but it also creates some tension between him and the two other boys who are trying to be the prince too. And in fact, those two boys, they're his rivals, but their kind of personalities or skills almost switch by the end of the book, which is kind of cool. So that really helps to keep your interest. And I think trying all these different activities or, you know, steps along the way to becoming the prince or building the tension all the way through. So I think it really helps to keep you interested in the story and what's happening.
And through this preparation, Sage endures a lot of physical trials and some torments, really. He seems to be, in much of the book, especially we get further in real bodily pain. And I was thinking, again, so many times in movies and sometimes even in books where heroes take up these awful beatings and they bounce back almost immediately as if nothing happened. That doesn't happen to Sage. When he experiences pain, it stays with him for quite a long time. And do you think it's important to let kids know that this is how humans react when they're in pain, that you can't just bounce back so quickly. It really does, you know, affect you for quite a while.
That's a really good point, actually. I think that's true. And I think this book does do that well, because he's not your typical hero where, you know, everything he does, he wins at. He struggles a little bit through this book to make his plans work and to get things to work out. And he does endure the physical pain as he goes along.
Have you had a chance to read any of the other books in the series?
Yes, I read all of them.
You have. Now, I know this might be difficult to do because you don't want to give away the ending of the book, but can you give, and I don't know how hard this might be, give some sort of sense for readers who enjoy this book, maybe what they might look forward to? I know that's asking a lot without trying to give any spoilers.
Well, I think the other two books in the series have similar kind of twists and turns. They're different. Of course, the different events happen in them, but I think they're just as exciting as this book, I would say. Like, I enjoyed all three of them. I wouldn't say, like, one of them is not as good as the others. I really enjoyed all of them, and they all had their surprising moments. And there was the same kind of action and sword play and a little bit of mystery. So they're all good read. It's a good series.
And from this book, The False Prince, is there a particular passage that stands out for you that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I like all of them, but I thought it might be interesting to read a little bit about where Sage is having his horseback riding lesson, because it really shows some of his character. I'm going to read a little bit about that. After our history lessons, Mott returned and escorted us to Connor's stables. Cragen was waiting for us there. His arms were folded so tightly as we approached. I briefly wondered if they were knotted. "That's right," he said grumpily. "I'll be teaching you to ride." After Mott was gone, he pointed to his saddle balanced on the top of a fence. "Let's start here. This is what you sit on to ride a horse." "You can't be serious," I said. "Are you really going to treat us like it's the first time we've seen a horse? We can all ride." "I don't know what your skills are," Cragen said. "My skills are better than yours," I said. "I can outride you with my eyes closed. Probably so can Tobias and Rodin." Cragen's eyes narrowed. "Better than my skills? I'm not just a rider, I'm a trainer. I break wild horses, and I can break you." I ignored that last part and said, "I can ride anything you can ride." Cragen smiled. "You won't bait me so easily, boy." "Why not?" Tobias said. "He says he can ride, test his skill." Cragen stared at Tobias, then me, then said, "All right, wait here," and walked back into the stalls. "Thanks," I said to Tobias. Tobias glanced sideways at me. "I'm not on your side, Sage. Hopefully this will teach you a lesson." Our attention was diverted by a crashing sound in the stables. Slowly, I shook my head and mumbled to Tobias, "You don't think he has an untrained horse in there, do you?"
"Sounds like it," Tobias said.
"Can you ride?" Tobias Roden asked me. "I've ridden before. Is that the same thing?"
"No," Tobias said flatly. "I can ride, but I'm not stupid enough to challenge Cregan to a wild horse."
"Just apologize and tell Cregan you want lessons," Roden said.
"And let everyone hold that over my head?" I asked. "I'll just ride the horse in a circle or two. It'll be fine."
Cregan was practically laughing aloud as he escorted a horse outside the stables. He was already trying to buck, and it was work for him to hold on to the reins. Cregan grinned wickedly. "So you can outride me?" I backed up two steps. My father had warned me about my quick tongue countless times. Perhaps he should have warned me more often. "Doesn't matter whether I could beat you or not. You're the tutor here." That seemed to offend Cregan. His voice rose in pitch as he said, "And as your tutor, I'm ordering you onto this horse." I shook my head. "I'm not riding that horse. Get me a tamer one and I'll do it. You just know you'll lose if you play fair." Cregan walked so close that I could feel his breath on me.
"Scared?"
"Yeah, I was. It was a fierce horse." "Then it's a good time to teach you some humility. Get on the horse or face the consequences."
"Leave him alone. Sage was just talking big," Roden said.
Cregan pointed a finger at Roden.
"Sage won't help you in the end, boy. Don't you help him."
Then he looked at me. "If you don't ride this horse now, then you won't ride again during the next 2 weeks. I'll tell Connor you failed here." After a very long moment, I reached for the reins.
"Fine, but I need help getting up."
Cregan laughed.
"Can't even mount a horse by yourself?"
"It's a riding contest, not a mounting one. Where's your horse?"
Cregan's laugh widened. "You'll fall off so quickly I wouldn't even have time to get into a saddle."
He steadied the horse while I climbed on. The horse bucked and I had to grip tightly to stay in the saddle.
"He doesn't like me," I said.
"You should be used to that," Cregan said. "And Windstorm is a she." With a laugh, he slapped the horse on the backside. Windstorm took off with a fury at her feet, throwing me hard against the curve of the saddle. Behind me, Cregan was laughing boisterously. Maybe Roden and Tobias were too. It was hard to tell with the whirl jostling around me. I yelped and held on as she pulled free of Cregan's control, and we sprinted away. Windstorm headed directly for a tree, as if she knew the low-hanging limb could knock me off. I ducked in time to avoid the worst of it, though some of the smaller branches scraped my shoulders as we passed beneath them. Somewhere behind us, Cregan yelled for me to come back, but Windstorm was on a full gallop to freedom. Cregan was left with the reality, but that by the time he got a horse to follow me, I'd be long gone, and I was on a horse running so fast that if I fell off, I was facing more than a few broken bones, or worse.
Well, that's a great passage.
Yeah, I really like how it shows Sage's personality, you know, how he kind of taunts people a little bit, but then when it comes down to it, he maybe is a little bit scared.
Andrea, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today about this book and share your thoughts about it.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a great book. I really like the story. And even though it has some big twists and turns, if you, like I've read it more than one time, when you read it again, you have a new perspective on it. So it's actually fun to read it for a second time.
You can find Andrea's website at andreamack.blogspot.com. Thank you for joining me on Dream Gardens. The theme music titled All Together is provided courtesy of Purple Planet Music. You can visit them at www.purpleplanet.com. Podcast cover art is provided by Creative Pro 180, courtesy of Fiverr, which can be found at www.fiverr.com. You can visit me at jleemott.com. or follow me on Twitter at DreamGardensJLM. The Dream Gardens podcast is also available through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. If you like what you hear, please comment, share, or subscribe. Until next time, keep dreaming, keep growing, and keep reading.